Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, May 29, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my own studio just north of New York City. Well, tonight at 7 p.m., ESPN will air E60's new documentary on Roy Halladay. The Hall of Fame pitcher passed away in November of 2017. And today we'll be talking with the co-directors of that piece about what they learned about Roy Halladay and why his widow, Brandy Halladay, felt it was important to speak truthfully about Roy. And my hope that this will start a larger conversation about the drug use of pitchers as they deal with the pain inherent in the work. We'll also be taking Todd Radom's weekly quiz and be talking about Pirates home ballpark, PNC. Before that, today could be another big day in the negotiation between the players and Major League Baseball. Today, the players could forward a counterproposal to the owners, although we saw from Max Scherzer the other night that the stance could be, no, we're not going to give anything back more than what we have on salaries. I've been told by sources that at least six owners want to shut down baseball for 2020. We saw some more social media infighting on the player side on Thursday. 2 days ago, Trevor Bauer sent out a tweet saying that agent Scott Boras should stay out of the negotiations. Yesterday, Kyle Loesch, a client of Boras, responded with this tweet. Trevor, I'm going to chalk this one up to immaturity. While your generation is talking MLB business while playing video games and complaining publicly how the union is doing us out-of-touch ex-ball players aren't happy standing by watching you wreck what was built. Bauer responded, okay, boomer. And he went on to write, Kyle, your time as a player has come and gone. You're no longer part of the player group negotiating. Everyone appreciates your time and your service, but you don't speak on behalf of players anymore. That time has come and gone for you. You're not privy to everything that's going on. That inherently means you're out of touch. It's not an insult. And then Lowe suggested that Bauer's gripe with Boras might be because he's dating his agent, Rachel Luba. And Bauer answered by calling Lowe sexist, and on it went. Here was something nice in the midst of all that. Francis Romero, I hope I pronounced his first name right, reports that David Price will pay $1,000 to each minor leaguer in the Dodgers farm system, not the guys in the 40-man roster, for the month of June. If you know David Price's history and his charitable giving, it's not a surprise. It's something that he does. In just a moment, we're going to talk with Brian Rivera and Mike Farrow, the co-directors, about the special edition of E60, about Roy Halladay. It's airing tonight at 7 p.m. Here's a trailer that E60 produced about the Roy Halladay piece.
Everybody on their feet. Halladay's got his signs. The 1-2 pitch. Hit toward third. Castro has it. Spins. Fires. A perfect game! Roy Halladay has thrown the second perfect game in Philadelphia Phillies history.
What comes to mind when I say the word perfect?
Unrealistic expectation. I don't think there's such a thing as perfect.
There's few pitchers that you can think about that you have this supreme respect for. He was the epitome of what a perfect pitcher should look like.
One of the greatest pitchers of his time. This absolutely stoic warrior.
One of the toughest in the game. Nobody wants to face Roy.
The work ethic was the best I've ever seen.
A man who was expected to be perfect or seen as perfect. I saw how hard that was on him.
Did you think he was an addict?
Yes.
Roy Halladay, the second no-hitter in postseason history.
He was tormented. His body was dependent on these medications just to function. ADD, depression, anxiety, paranoia. Roy had a lot of demons that he was trying to work on all at the same time.
What do you think he got out of flying?
Freedom. one of my last texts were, be careful with that thing.
911, what's the address of your emergency?
A plane just now crashed up here in a place called Sand Bay.
Roy would want everyone to know that people are not perfect. We all struggle. But with hard work, humility, and dedication, imperfect people can still have perfect moments.
Perfect. I hate that word, perfect.
Mike Farrell, Brian Rivera are co-directors of the E60 documentary Imperfect about the late Hall of Fame pitcher Roy Halladay, which airs tonight on ESPN at 7 p.m. Eastern. Mike, thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing well this morning. Thank you.
Brian, thanks for joining us.
We appreciate you having us, Buster.
It is an excellent piece. It was a bracing piece. I watched it yesterday, and I knew a lot about Roy Halladay, but boy, did I learn so much more, especially about his career, his life, his time after baseball. Mike, just to start with, why do you feel like Brandy Halladay chose to participate in this piece?
I think that her motivation, to put it very simply, was to try to use Roy's story to help others. We were very, very sensitive to the fact that, you know, Roy is gone. We don't want to be dragging up bad memories or dirt or, you know, to be speaking ill of him after he's gone. It's vulnerability from Brandy with a purpose. She really wanted to make sure that by showing the human side of Roy, showing the fact that he struggled, can show anyone out there that anyone can struggle, even somebody that is as invincible seeming as Roy Halladay was. And so really the point is to just show viewers that it doesn't matter if you're making $20 million a year and pitching perfect games and no hitters in the playoffs, or if you're just a regular person like Brian and I, everyone can struggle with mental illness and addiction, and there's no shame. There should be no shame in that struggle.
And Brian, it really felt like in watching this piece, it was almost an extension for her of the Hall of Fame speech she gave in Cooperstown last year.
Yeah, it was, Buster. You know, that speech is something that Mike and I were kind of waiting for after we initially talked about this idea. I started this conversation with Mike, you know, a few weeks before the Hall of Fame induction happened, and he and I kicked around some ideas about pursuing a story about Roy, but we were really kind of stuck on this one question that we just couldn't quite answer for ourselves. And this, of course, was before Brandy spoke at the Hall of Fame, which was, why would Brandy Halladay and the rest of the Halladay family want to do something like this with us? And then we saw Brandy's speech at Roy's induction at Cooperstown. And Mike really seized upon Brandy's line, which we have in the trailer and is, you know, in the documentary, about Roy would want people to know that even imperfect people are capable of perfect moments. And that line, you know, hit Mike particularly hard, and he brought it to me and we started talking about it. And from there, we decided we felt like we had possibly a reason that Brandy had kind of cracked the door into their lives open just wide enough that there might be incentive for her to sit down and just share her story and Roy's story with everyone else, with baseball fans and with the sports community at large, and even people, you know, to Mike's point earlier, who are not in the sports world, but, you know, have battled some of these things that Roy went through and their family went through with him.
Mike, Sports Illustrated published a piece last summer which suggested, but didn't say to definitively, raised the possibility that he had committed suicide. And in watching that Hall of Fame speech, it felt like that Brandy was answering that directly. And again, it felt like that in your piece without knowing the absolute truth.
Yeah, it's a very sensitive subject matter. Certainly Brandy, in our interview, we did ask her about that. We didn't include it in the documentary, but we did ask her specifically about that idea. And she was very vehement and very passionate in her denial that he did not commit suicide.
We spoke to eyewitnesses from the crash. John Barr, our reporter, spoke with an eyewitness who said there was no doubt that he was trying to pull up at the end. And so, you know, with a situation like this, you're just never going to know for sure. But from what Brandy tells us, Roy was getting into a better place in his life in those final months and was realizing that being normal was okay. He was coaching his sons in baseball, and was sort of getting to a better spot with retirement. And so from everyone we've talked to, from eyewitnesses to Roy's family, they all feel very strongly like that was not the case. Of course, we can never know for sure, but that's what they communicated to us in our conversations.
If I could jump in real quick to just add on to that and just reiterate, you know, the point that Mike just made. You know, we interviewed, you know, almost, I want to say close to 15 people. And we brought this up to some of Roy's closest friends outside of his family. We brought it up to each member of his family, and everyone was unified in their, you know, total belief that this was a tragic accident and that Roy would not have done something like that, especially given the fact that he had kind of he had started to move beyond, I think, being kind of bogged down on a daily basis by a lot of these issues. He and Brandy were in counseling together kind of for their marriage. He, you know, had been actively seeking treatment for his addictions. And, you know, according to Brandy, he had kind of begun to turn a corner, right before this accident occurred. So everyone that we spoke to was, you know, kind of vehement in their, stance that Roy, you know, was not the person or was not in a place where he would have, you know, intentionally harmed himself.
Guys, I got to say, in watching the piece, the footage that you used at the outset absolutely took my breath away. As best you can you describe what it was and how you got it?
That footage came from a cinematographer who had done some work with Icon Aircraft leading up to Roy's purchase of the A5. And, you know, at the time, Roy had become one of the kind of early spokespeople for the A5 aircraft that Icon had put out. And, you know, Icon had decided to film a lot of Roy's kind of, you know, early experiences with the plane, whether it was going through flight safety training in the plane kind of for the first time and some subsequent training sessions that he had, in addition to being there when Roy saw his plane, which was manufactured specifically for him for the very first time. And so this footage came to our attention in kind of a roundabout way, kind of a serendipitous way. I was actually shooting another feature for E60 in late June of 2019. And I happened to be shooting with the same crew, film crew that had shot that footage of Roy. And after we wrapped the shoot, this was all unknown to me at the time when we began the shoot and when I hired this particular crew. And when we wrapped our shoot that day for a story that was entirely unrelated to Roy, the crew and myself went to lunch and we just began talking. And somehow, and I this is, you know, a key point of the story, although I can't remember, somehow Roy Halladay came up and these shooters told me they had been the ones who had spent time with Roy at Icon and had actually flown with him and shot him flying the plane for several months. And that this footage was something that they had and that they had owned. And that obviously Icon, you know, in the wake of the crash, there was, of course, everybody can understand a greater sensitivity about putting that footage out in any kind of promotional use. So it was shelved and it sat on their shelf for, you know, from October of 2017 until, you know, late summer when we began a conversation about trying to acquire it from them. So, you know, it was a long process to get it from them. They had a lot of concerns about the way we were going to use it. As you can imagine, Buster, it was something that we did not acquire officially until very recently, given all of the concerns surrounding it. But we are, you know, thrilled to have it as a part of this project. We feel it makes the project a more complete picture of who Roy was, given his interest in aviation. And, you know, we're hoping that everyone else who watches the documentary tonight will have the same reaction that you did. And I'll turn it to Mike if he wants to add anything.
Well, I was just going to jump in real quick and say that I got to tell you, just having known Roy, you know, a little bit and gotten to know him just as a reporter to a player, it kind of broke my heart watching it and why it was so striking. Mike, what do you remember about the first time that you saw it?
It took my breath away, very similar in fashion to you, Buster. It's very jarring to watch it with the benefit of hindsight and knowing what happened. It's chilling. I mean, when I watched it down for the very first time, when we got some screener copies of the footage to review, the moment that made the hair on the back of my neck stand up was when Roy sat in the plane for the first time and was smiling like a kid in a candy store. And of all the words in the English language to utter, he said, "Perfect." And at that point, it was just like my spine tingled, and it was, you know, crazy. But that's how he felt about the plane. He was so excited to get it. And you could see that he's just in awe in that scene of the aircraft. And aviation, as Brian said, was something he was passionate about and loved his entire life. So it's equal parts, you know, eerie, shocking, heartbreaking. It's all of those things. But it does show, you know, his love for flying in real time.
I'm curious about what each of you learned about him that surprised you as you went through the project. Mike, start with you.
For me, it was Brandy talking about Roy's anxiety and Roy's fear of failure, Roy's incessant desire to please others and to not let people down. She spoke about that over and over again in our interview. And I mean, that description just seems so at odds with the image of him that we have on the mound, which is this like stone cold dominant pitcher that showed such little emotion, noted for his stoicism almost as much as his work ethic. And, you know, to hear that that's what he was really like behind closed doors was very surprising to me. But, you know, there's a lot of people, whether it be major league pitchers or just in everyday life, that put on a form of a mask on a daily basis and project one personality when another one might, you know, lie beneath the surface. And that, again, just speaks to what our hope is with this documentary, is that if somebody maybe watches this and can help shed the shame and the feeling, the need to project strength when maybe, you know, anxiety is below, then I think that the film serves its purpose. But that was the most surprising thing to me, was hearing just how scared and anxious he was at times throughout his career and throughout his life and in various situations, whether it be pitching in front of 45,000 people or going to a small cocktail party, you know?
Brian? You know, we really got to find out how much of a sense of humor Roy Halladay had. And I don't think that that's something that anybody would have ever thought about or even really known about unless you really, really, really paid attention, particularly to his Twitter feed after he passed away, which is still up. And, you know, again, I'm not sure how many people actually spent time poking through his Twitter feed while he was alive, but in going back through it now, you know, I would encourage anybody who, you know, is a fan of Roy Halladay or ends up watching this doc to just poke through, because the guy really was funny. And, you know, one particular thing that stands out is, you know, you can find this on YouTube. Roy was inducted into the Colorado Sports Hall of Fame in 2015, and he gave an induction speech that again, I think surprised a lot of people because it was actually funny. And it's on YouTube. We feature it at the end of the documentary, Buster, as you know, having watched. And, you know, Roy tells a few kind of stories and takes some shots at himself, you know, very self-deprecating, very humble, but also funny. And his family talked about that. Brandy talked about that. And it's evident, if you're kind of paying close attention to these kind of little areas in his life where you can get a little glimpse into it. I mentioned the Hall of Fame induction speech being one, but also, you know, his Twitter feed and even in some of the interviews that he did, I think people kind of missed that part of him along the way. So that was something that struck me. And I hope that that's something that people get a little taste of maybe at the end of the documentary.
It's funny that the sense of humor really came out when you're looking at the raw interview clips. And it's those moments in between filming or before the interview begins where you really saw Roy's sense of humor shine. I mean, I think he felt maybe a sense of obligation to kind of turn on the baseball player persona when the cameras were rolling. But when we look at the raw interview tapes and even the brief glimpses of moments before and during takes is when that sense of humor really shone through, which was interesting for me to see.
Oh, 100%. I've worked on a number of E60 pieces, and there is ultimately heartbreak at the end of the process because of stuff, to borrow your phrase, Brian, that winds up on the cutting room floor. For each of you, give me something that you're like, oh, I wish we could have included that.
For me, and I mentioned this to you as we came on, I actually woke up this morning very early, as I've woken up every morning during the editing process of this piece, just unable to sleep, thinking about things. And I was going to text this to Mike and I didn't, but he can hear it now. I really miss an opening to our second segment of the documentary, which Mike built with an interview clip that you did from 2003 with Roy after he had kind of come back after being sent down to the minors. And in that interview clip, there are a number of technical issues befalling the production. The lights are going out, cell phones are going off, and it happens throughout the course of the entire 15-minute interview. And Roy, graciously, but also with a sense of humor, which again is evident kind of in between the moments and the answers, is very playful and very understanding. And I think that scene that Mike built of him, which was going to be a part of our second segment of this documentary, really illustrated that point earlier in the story than we might get to it now. But it's something that I do miss, and I wish, you know, we had more time, we certainly would have gotten it in.
For me, it's the storyline with his son, Braden. We actually had a very talented associate producer on our show named Scott Sikowski put together a separate feature on Braden. I went to Penn State University a couple months ago and spent a few days with Braden there. He's a freshman pitcher at Penn State, and just such a likable, nice, down-to-earth kid. He just looks like Roy in so many ways, not only physically, but in his mechanics and delivery. There's sort of a kind of warm but eerie nature to the images that we captured of him pitching. And I think in a lot of ways, in talking to Braden, you know, he's taken lessons from Roy, from both his successes and his struggles, and has tried to incorporate those into his own journey as he pursues pitching as potentially a career for himself. And I find that choice interesting in its own right, as he saw firsthand the mental and physical strain that it put on his father. So, you know, we were able to get a separate feature done on Braden with the stuff that we captured at Penn State to give him, you know, a time to kind of show his relationship with his father a little bit more. So that is going to get out there in some capacity, but it would have been fulfilling to have that weaved into our narrative a little bit more in the documentary presentation.
Brian, when I sat down with you, I mentioned to you as you were, you know, give me some of the background that you guys had dug out on this, that when I first saw the toxicology report after the crash, I was kind of like, nope, that doesn't surprise me. Because in my time covering baseball, I've seen a lot of pitchers and heard of a lot about pitchers going into retirement with pill problems, with pharmaceutical problems. because of all the pain management that they do during their careers, especially at the end of their careers, because they pitch in pain. And you guys note that Roy's physical problems really started with a back issue, and then it expanded, and then he began to use pharmaceuticals on a regular basis. And I wouldn't at all be surprised. Brandy made reference to the idea of, you know, hopefully this helps someone. I think there will be former pitchers. You're going to hear about former pitchers and their struggles with painkillers after watching this. And in fact, when I was doing the broadcast on from the games from South Korea this morning, Kyle Peterson, our colleague here at ESPN, when I mentioned that, he said, yeah, in 2001, you know, I started taking Vicodin. And so I really feel like that you're going to have you're going to reach a lot of people in the game with by sharing Roy's experience and his issues with those.
I hope you're right, Buster. I think if that was the outcome of this documentary, it would, you know, far exceed even our hopes for what we were kind of intending for it to achieve. That's another conversation that we never had going into the production of this documentary, but it's one that developed particularly when you and I started talking. And I think it's a really interesting one to have. You know, Brandy talks about Roy not taking prescription painkillers to get high, but taking them because he needed them to function, to do his job as a pitcher. And, you know, Todd Zalecki, who has written a book on Roy Halladay, has written Halladay's biography, is in our piece, featured in our piece. We did an interview with him, and he talks about the pressure that Roy felt as the Phillies' $20 million a year ace to live up to and deliver, you know, a third, live up to the expectations that the fans had for him, that the organization may have had for him, and deliver the fans, you know, a third consecutive trip to the World Series. And so because of the physicality that I think a lot of fans, the physicality of pitching that I think a lot of fans take for granted, because as we've talked about, you know, it's a non-contact sport, and we take, you know, the movement of one's arm for granted because it's kind of something we all can do. You know, Mike has catch with his son. You have a catch with yours. We've all had catches, you know, and thrown a baseball with our friends, with our dads. And it's just kind of something you take for granted. But, you know, if you think about it, once you come in from the catch, you know, 30 minutes later, your arm is sore and you've maybe been throwing the ball 20 or 30 miles an hour, not 100 miles an hour, to get 27 major league outs. So I think, you know, if that conversation is started out of this, it would wildly exceed our hopes for, you know, what we can achieve, by getting this message out there and shining light on this issue kind of inadvertently.
In my time covering baseball, like the mantra for starting pitchers, you take the ball. It's your responsibility to take the ball every fifth day. When I was covering the Yankees, there was a period of time when Andy Pettit had discomfort in his elbow. And I remember talking to Roger Clemens where he was saying, you know, Andy's got to learn how to pitch with pain. That's part of the game. That's part of what we do. And I think that for some of them, the use of pharmaceuticals is part of that, Mike.
Yeah. And I remember you saying in the interview, Buster, that you had a doctor one time tell you that every time a major league pitcher throws a pitch, he's effectively dislocating his shoulder every single time. And when you think about it in that context, I mean, it seems there would be an inevitability that pain would be a constant in the lives of pitchers, especially as they get later in their careers. And yeah, I just think that as sports fans, like, we're wired to think of painkillers and playing through pain for like sports more like football, or, you know, me growing up in Canada, certainly I associated with hockey, these sort of contact sports that are more violent in nature, that, you know, collisions are part of the everyday ongoings of the sport. But when you actually stop and think about what a person is doing to their body while pitching, it makes total sense that painkillers would also be an issue in that fraternity.
Great job with this, guys, and thanks for taking the time to talk about it.
Sure thing, Buster. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks very much.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Or you can go to his website, ToddRadom.com. And Todd, as we bring you in, last night we had even more out in the open about the negotiations going on between the players and the owners, except this was player-on-player crime. Yeah. Twitter back and forth between Kyle Loesch and Trevor Bauer. I did Michael Kay's show yesterday, and I told him that I was embarrassed watching this. Like, watching this is beginning to feel like two second cousins at a memorial service arguing loudly in the back pews. And you just cringe as you hear it. Like, every time somebody talks about money out loud in the current context, it feels totally inappropriate. And I think it's going to damage all of them.
Buster, you're saying these words, and I am literally just instinctively sitting here shaking my head, and I got my head in my hand cringing, because you're absolutely right. I'm going to come at it from a little bit of a different perspective. You know, I've worked in baseball in my lane, a little bit of a different thing, admittedly, but on the business side for 30 years. And I have relationships with people in the commissioner's office, with people with the PA, with licensees. And I think that all of this is governed. Navigating it successfully is a product, I believe, of discretion. Bite your tongue. Know when to talk, know when not to talk, hold things in confidence, and for goodness sake, just, you know, before you, this should apply to everything as it relates to social media. Think twice, hit send once. I mean, it is just horrible to watch this play out.
Yeah, and when I saw in particular those tweets, Kyle Loesch, by the way, is a great guy. I don't know Trevor Bauer as well as you know Kyle Loesch, but I know Kyle Loesch is a good guy. But when I saw the tweets and the back and forth, I'm like, good God. Can somebody just get his phone number and call him directly, Todd?
Yeah. It's probably pretty easy to do. And listen, Trevor Bauer has a reputation as a guy who is, I don't know, a bit of a free spirit. And that is a refreshing thing, and good on him, you know. But at this particular moment in time, as a world, as a country, as a society, and knowing that the window of opportunity, you know, whether this season is going to get played in a truncated form or not. Again, I don't want to debate the merits of that. I don't want to get into money, millionaires, billionaires. This whole discussion always comes into play. But just bite your tongue. Don't hit send. And I will get down off my soapbox.
All right. Before you get off it, I do want to hear about your views on PNC Park, which is one of my favorites. Because Camden Yards, close to my heart, that's always number one for me. I love the ballpark in San Francisco. Pittsburgh would be number three for me. What about for you?
All right. Well, we get onto a much nicer thing to talk about with PNC Park. No question, Buster. I believe that it's quite possibly baseball's most beautiful ballpark. Is that possible?
Yes.
Because I think of PNC Park, and the first thing you do, if you were to like be led into PNC Park with your eyes closed and said, okay, open your eyes, you see this, what I have always termed a Disney-esque view of downtown Pittsburgh, and those bridges and the angles of the buildings. The architecture is just startlingly interesting. And there are a couple of things that I've jotted down that I love about PNC Park. I love the scale of it. It is two decks. It is modest. It has always seemed like a ballpark that fits the size of Pittsburgh, which is not a huge metropolis. It just seems right. As far as the ballpark itself, I love the materials there. That's local limestone exterior and that area behind home plate. I love the colors, the blue steel. It just seems really, really comfortable there. It's built on a very modest footprint. The setting, the views, the textures, the colors of the stadium, all of it. You know, let's face it, you and I have talked about this many times in the past, Buster. We are old enough to remember when the Pirates were an MLB powerhouse, participating in World Series, winning divisions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I've always said that that ballpark, as well received as it is, would get even more of a halo effect if the Pirates were good at all. And they haven't been, you know, with rare exception, for a long time.
I love the tribute that's built into the ballpark to Roberto Clemente. Yeah. Right field, if you can explain that, because you're the expert.
I haven't been there in a while, but I know, you know, you've got the Clemente statue, you've got the bridge out there.
The wall is 21 feet high.
Yeah, there you go. And I mean, you know, you talk about Clemente, of course, played his career at Forbes Field, which is not anywhere near there, but, you know, Three Rivers right near there. The bridge, the Clemente Bridge, approaching PNC Park as a pedestrian from downtown Pittsburgh across the river on the Clemente Bridge, you get a sense of, you know, the history, and the Pirates do the history so, so well. And I know that's ebbed and flowed over the years. They, celebrated the Negro League's rich history. I will give a quick shout out at this point to Sean Gibson, who I know, who is the descendant of Josh Gibson, runs the Josh Gibson Foundation out there. So much, so much history, and what an amazing ballpark. Like you, I would put it right up there at the top of my list. We're going to be talking about this a lot. I don't know how you compare PNC Park to a Fenway or a Wrigley, to name two of the older ones. We talked about Dodger Stadium. Again, different flavors. We're talking the same language. PNC is a gem.
It really is. On the other hand, Three Rivers, absolutely nothing stands out about it to me in my time when I went there, other than I mentioned to you last week about jogging in different ballparks. That was one of the ballparks I would jog in after games. And it was perfectly oval and nice and easy to run in. That's for sure.
And there you go, Buster. You talk about close your eyes and be put into Three River Stadium, and you'd say, am I in Cincinnati? Am I in Philadelphia?
Right.
The colors of the seats might vary, but other than that, not a whole lot to think about. I am all of a sudden recalling being at a game at Three Rivers in April of 1987. I can tell you exactly when it was. It was empty. And somebody hits a fly ball. I'm sitting with my friends in the upper deck, roughly behind home plate, first row. And this ball comes, and these two just huge guys get right in our grill and take the foul ball away from us. I mean, that's my memory.
Wow.
So my memory of Three River Stadium, Buster, not good.
I'd say in the ballpark before that, you made reference to it, Forbes Field, in a weird sort of way. Forbes Field was like the Mayflower of all the modern ballparks because, of course, Forbes Field was the favorite of Larry Lucchino, who went on to work for the Baltimore Orioles, and he was inspired by Forbes Field as they built Camden Yards. And as we talked about a few weeks ago with Janet Marie Smith, that was the inspiration for ballparks elsewhere. What do you got on Forbes Field?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it predates us by enough years that you and I never would have been there. But you look at pictures of this place, and it was just exquisitely designed. The architectural details are stunning. The setting in the Oakland neighborhood, and Buster, I cannot help but think, and I think both you and Taylor will know exactly what I'm talking about. There's this iconic shot of the seventh game of the 1960 World Series taken from atop the Cathedral of Learning. That big skyscraper, that tower there, looking down on Forbes Field, and it is just striking. This moment in time, all of the get past the history part, the setting, all of the trees, it just looks like a beautiful, beautiful ballpark. And I know that there are pieces of it that are still in existence out there, including a section of the outfield wall where Bill Mazeroski's home run cleared to win the 1960 World Series. I'm pretty sure home plate is there, too. Someday when we're allowed to leave the house, we got to do a ballpark remnant road trip.
Oh, that would be fun, Todd. Yeah, absolutely. And I actually, you know, as you said that, I'm like, there are two or three places in the area, other historical sites that I want to see. So you and I are going to talk about that. And we have established that Three Rivers, definitely the ugly stepchild of the three ballparks that the Pirates have made famous. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, guys. Here we go. We're going to stay in the National League. Which one of these teams has appeared in the most National League championship series? The Pirates, the Dodgers, the Braves, or the Cardinals? Most appearances in the NLCS. Pirates,
wow.
Dodgers, Braves, Cardinals.
Wow. Taylor, you want to give it a shot?
I will go with the Cardinals on this one.
And the Cardinals have certainly made the most World Series appearances, but I'm going to go with a team that tortured me at times going to the National League Championship Series, and that would be my childhood favorite team, the Dodgers.
Taylor, you are the victor this week.
Oh, man.
14 appearances by the same.
Good job, Taylor.
And Buster, you were close because the Dodgers have appeared in 13, including a lot in recent times. So, Taylor, good job, my friend.
Wow.
Yeah.
I thought way Buster was some sort of baseball savant, but I guess not. I guess I'm the true savant on this podcast.
It's kind of interesting because, you know, I alluded to it earlier and it had nothing to do with the correctness of this question. But the Pirates have appeared in 9 NLCS. When you think about, you know, let's face it, we all know that the event, the NLCS dates back to 1969. And the Pirates, of course, were this powerhouse franchise. And then all of a sudden, you know, they hit the wall at a certain point, but they have appeared in 9 NLCS along the way.
And I, you know, remember Jack Buck sort of joyfully talking about Ozzie, whatever. I'm not going to get into it as a Dodger fan, but I was very bitter from those games. And I'm very bitter for losing again. All right, Todd, I appreciate it.
All right, guys, thanks so much.
The businesses around ballparks all around America have gone dormant during this time without baseball, like Wrigleyville Dogs. This piece was generated by SportsCenter.
There is literally no one on the street here. The tables are empty, but we are open for business.
This is Harry Strallis, and this is Wrigleyville Dogs, known for their famous Chicago-style hot dogs. It's right up the block from Wrigley Field, home of the Chicago Cubs. This is Harry's dad, Pete. He opened Wrigleyville Dogs 30 years ago. Up until mid-March, Pete was still working, but not now. At 81, that's too risky.
As long as he has his health, he's going to be okay.
A little bouncer slowly toward Bryant. He will glove and throw to Rizzo. It's in time, and the Chicago Cubs win the World Series.
There must have been at least, I don't know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people. It was fantastic for us. It was fantastic for the fans.
Now, with no baseball, Harry says business is down close to 80%. He's not taking a salary. He's turned cooks into delivery drivers. Harry says the only reason the restaurant remains open is to keep their devoted employees employed.
They need to know that they have some type of income coming in. Otherwise, what do they do? As a community, Wrigleyville is pretty damn strong. But we need baseball back. We need baseball to be played in Wrigley Field in front of fans that are cheering and love the team and want to be there.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Last batch of Bleacher Tweets for the week. First up, Jacob Habel. He tweeted me earlier and said, thanks for pronouncing my name correctly. Habel. Now I'm going to botch it for sure. So apologies, Jacob. He writes in, it feels like fans are the only child stuck in the middle of a nasty divorce where neither parent, players, or owners want us. What do fans do to voice how we feel? Boycott games in 2021? Do we all become NBA fans? Premier League lacrosse sounds like it's going to go off without a hitch this summer. What do you think, Buster?
Yeah, Jacob, what you just suggested is something that I've heard voiced by players, by agents, by people on management side. They cringe that there is going to be a serious backlash from fans, much in the way there was after the 94-95 player strike.
A little bit of a follow-up to that. Ben Hedge, Heggy? Ooh, I'm on a roll here today. At Big Head Benny 13 writes in, MLB media and fans say they want players to be more open and have less robotic answers. Why does it seem when players do open up and speak their feelings, he's pointing to Blake Snell specifically, they get crucified by those very media members. No wonder no one talks. And I think it's with this, you know, with Blake Snell, this is a whole kind of different situation. This is different than a trite
apples and oranges.
Yeah.
Apples and oranges. There's one thing to give an interview after the game or talk at a microphone during the game. And on the other hand, the current situation during a pandemic to talk about money.
Absolutely. Last one from our pal Aaron at AA Ron San Diego writes in, what are the disagreements happening in terms of safety? All we are hearing is that they disagree, but it seems to me like this is only an attempt to cover for money disputes. If there are any specifics, I'd love to hear them.
Aaron, generally speaking, what I've heard is the players want more testing. But let's face it, there are disagreements, and they might even be major disagreements over safety. The bigger disagreements are over money. There's not going to be baseball in 2020 if they cannot settle those financial disagreements.
Yeesh. All right, well, Premier League's back June 17th, so there will be something to watch. Thanks for writing in, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.
That's it for today. My thanks to Brian, Mike, Todd, and Taylor. Taylor, I don't mean to be – I always feel like Dr. Doom. Like, I try, but I want to be honest. I want to be real about things.
I appreciate your honesty, and I appreciate the fact that you've kind of been on this since – the very beginning. I mean, we were talking mid-March and you were kind of doom and gloom about it, and now it's materialized. So if anything, it just proves your foresight on this particular subject.
And the part that I was right about that makes me cringe is that I was writing back in mid-March, don't fight publicly about this situation. We've been talking about that for weeks on the podcast. Anyway, have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.